We'll hear arguments next in Flagg Brothers against Brooks and the related and consolidated cases. Well, all they do with a thing like that is take age, and over here are two columns, male and female, and go down and... I sold annuities. I remember once when the biggest one I ever sold when I was going to law school was for $300 a month for life. And price for the joint and survivorship annuity was $54,000, single premium. Mm-hmm. If it was just to pay it to the wife, not to the husband, or just to the husband through his
wife,
it was $32,000.
Yep.
There was no profit in the companies. A lot of companies just quit selling annuities because it's too much grief. We're going to have litigation like this for years on these acts. Every time we come down with a decision, there'd be a lobby in to amend the statute.
That's right. Title VII is just the invention of the devil. Hubert Humphrey's great moment. Mind it up.
Mr. Altman, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The issue before the court is the presence or absence of state action in the sale by a warehouseman of household goods, a sale of the household goods deposited by a warehouse depositor who has defaulted in payment of the storage charges, the sale being made pursuant to New York Uniform Commercial Code, Section 7-210. The petitioner is the warehouseman. Respondents are two depositors of warehouse goods, household goods. While the facts in each case are not identical, they are substantially similar. Both respondents, tenants in an apartment dwelling in Mount Vernon, New York, were evicted from their respective apartments by court order. On the day of the eviction, the petitioner warehouseman, acting on behalf of the landlord, the evicting landlord, to effectuate the removal of the household goods from the apartment to the sidewalk, appeared at the apartment and entered into discussions with the respondents. I may point out to the court that these two occasions did not occur on the same day. They were separate occasions on different days. As a result of the discussion in the Brooks case, respondent Brooks requested that her household effects be removed from the apartment to the petitioner's warehouse rather than leaving the goods on the sidewalk. In the Jones case, the respondent Jones was present with the warehouseman in the apartment at the time of discussion, made a call to the Department of Social Services for the purpose of obtaining approval for getting funds to pay the transportation charges and to pay storage charges. This was confirmed by letter of the Department of Social Warehouses, Social Services. The Department of Social Services approved 1 month's storage. After a period of time elapsed, both accounts became in arrears, and the warehouseman threatened to sell in conformity with Section 7-210. Respondents sought an injunction relief and a declaration from the United States District Court that Section 7-210 was unconstitutional, being in violation of the 14th Amendment due process. The District Court, on motion of the warehouseman, dismissed the case on the ground that state action was not present. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals reversed. Since the bedrock principle of the 14th Amendment is a prohibition against state action and not individual action, no matter how harmful or hurtful, the question is whether the state of New York was so involved in the sale that the action of the warehouseman may be fairly treated as the action of the state of New York.
Mr. Altman, in that connection, just as a matter of curiosity, if you prevail here, what remedies do the respondents have under the New York system for any alleged wrongs?
If we prevail here, Your Honor, the remedies of the respondents are, of course, to go into court to enjoin any action in which they feel the warehouseman has not complied with the rigorous safeguards of the statute.
Or damages, if they have?
They have an action for damages, Mr. Chief Justice, for any infraction of the statute, no matter how minute, and they have an action for conversion in the event that the infraction is a willful one.
Well, really, all the respondents are complaining about is that the UCC gives your client an additional defense to a claim for conversion in the state courts in New York, isn't it?
Well, that is so, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but of course, in addition, they have taken the position that the conferral of the right of sale upon the warehouseman is an action associated with sovereignty, is a right associated with sovereignty, which we deny.
If the UCC weren't even in existence,
yes, sir,
and there was nothing on the books at all with respect to what a warehouseman could do, common law or statutory law, presumably if the warehouseman, without any contractual right to do so, took a bailor's goods out and sold them, the bailor could sue for conversion.
Yes, sir.
And the UCC simply says, if you follow these, what you describe as rigorous procedures, and I presume your opponent characterizes them otherwise, you will have a defense to that state court action,
yes,
for conversion.
Sir.
There's no attack here on the, even assuming there's state action, there's no attack on the lien itself, is there?
No, Your Honor. The only attack is on the conferral of the right of sale.
On the conferral of the right to sell, and in
yes,
fact,
sir,
in these cases, there was no sale with respect to either one of the named parties.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Dead. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was there a contract between the warehouseman and the party who's been restored?
In the one case, Mr. Justice Powell, there was a storage receipt, a warehouse receipt, which we claim has all of the elements of the contract in it.
The warehouse receipt in the record here.
There is the warehouse receipt of the particular petitioner warehouseman, and there is also a warehouse receipt which is used more commonly throughout the industry. So the court has before it the receipt issued in this particular case plus the receipt which is in common usage.
Does that receipt, the one issued in this case, refer to section 7-210?
Not in those words, Your Honor.
What does it say that's relevant to this case, if anything?
There is a provision in that warehouse receipt which confers the right of sale by the warehouseman in the event of a default in payment. However, there is no specific pointing out of section 7-210.
Could you rely on that contract rather than the New York statute? You can in a deed of trust in my state.
We believe that you can rely on that contract. Mm-hmm. Of course, in this case, if I may point out, Your Honor, we have a special situation in that it was an emergency situation. There was not the normal time to prepare the storage contract, the warehouse receipt, in the ordinary case where there is a removal to storage. This was an emergency whereby the goods were being removed to the sidewalk, and in order to prevent that, the warehouseman took the goods into storage.
Did the bailor sign the warehouse receipt?
No, Your Honor.
So how could it be a contract then?
We submit that there was an implied contract based on all of the facts in this instance.
But not a writing signed by the party to be charged.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, it's like if you want to store your goods, you store them on these terms or we won't store them. And so they stored the goods. That's what it amounts to.
Not quite, Your Honor, if I may disagree. There was...
Well, what more is there, in this case at least?
There was the right...
In terms of a contract.
Well, right. There was the right of the bailor to obtain a different warehouseman if she did not agree to the terms specified by this particular warehouseman.
Well, the choice
you couldn't suggest that she knew anything, had any notion of what the terms were when you took the goods away. It was an emergency, as you said.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
The choice was either give it to him or leave it on the street.
Or try to obtain the services of another warehouseman. That's true, Mr. Justice Marshall.
But your implied contract must imply a power of sale, which is in the written contract, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chief.
How do you imply a power of sale in just a storage contract?
Well, Your Honor, we imply it first because the statute itself should be considered, and the statute itself should be considered in the terms of the contract. That is one way. And then we say, Your Honor, that this
is the statute's a limitation on the power of the parties to contract, is it not?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. Yes, it is definitely a limitation.
Why shouldn't the warehouseman frame a contract that would solve this problem, consistent with the terms of the statute?
That could very well be done, and that is the case, Mr. Justice Powell. In the vast majority of warehouse deposits, the contracts are specific on this point. The documentation, the warehouse receipt of the storage contract, it so happens in this particular case that was not done for the reasons that I had mentioned.
This case came to the Court of Appeals after the district court dismissed a complaint.
Yes, sir.
And the posture of the case, therefore, is that we assume that the allegations of the complaint are all true. And there's, taking those allegations, there's no contract in this case. The question, as you quite accurately said at the outset of your argument, and the only question before us is whether the action of your client was state action.
That's correct,
isn't
sir.
Isn't that right?
That's correct, sir. We respectfully submit that state involvement in a disputed private act must be significant, affirmative, all but ordering the challenged activity, and that the delegation of sovereign power in an economic due process setting is insufficient to cross the state action threshold. We would point out that the New York Commercial Code is a permissive statute. There is no direction in the statute to sell. The decision to sell is the decision of the warehouseman. It's a private decision arrived at by a private party in a private transaction with no state official being present, no state encouragement whatsoever.
But on that point, Mr. Altman, without a contract and without a statute, do you think your client would have gone ahead and sold?
Without a contract and without the statute.
You say that, isn't the statute a fairly important part of the whole picture?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Otherwise, you'd have had to go to court to foreclose your lien.
That is correct.
Yes.
That is correct.
And the question, I guess, is whether it's under color of state law in the sense that it's something that would not have been done without the statute.
That's right, sir. And on that issue, may I say that the conferral of this right of sale is not the delegation of a power associated with sovereignty. Far from being a power associated with sovereignty, this statute is a codification of a power to dispose of property which any private party had at common law. The power of sale was an attribute of ownership, and at common law, possession was presumed to be ownership.
But if we, now, do you think under the law of bailor or bailee at common law, the bailee could sell the property without aid of the court?
The bailee could sell the property under common law if possession had been voluntarily delivered to him. Yes, Mr. Justice.
Without going to court at all?
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you one more question, if I may, Mr. Altman. So supposing that contrary to your answer to Mr. Justice White, at common law, the bailee had absolutely no power to sell without going to court. But the New York Court of Appeals, without any statute at all, had said, we're not going to follow that branch of the common law. We're going to enunciate a new principle that the bailee does have the power to sell. So that without statute, but as a result of decisional law of the New York Court of Appeals, your client would have the same right as now conferred on him by statute. Do you think the case would be any different here?
No, you don't.
Insofar as a seizure is not concerned in this case, insofar as possession was delivered voluntarily, I don't think that there would be any difference.
Mr. Greenwald?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My co-counsel has stated the relevant facts of this case. The Attorney General of the State of New York has intervened at the district court level, by the way, to defend the constitutionality of a state law. And at this time, there's only one provision involved, Uniform Commercial Code, Section 7-210. And, of course, the New York State Legislature several years ago passed that statute, but it is my contention that that is not enough to make this a matter of state action. I think there's really no dispute about that. And
that is a simple enactment of the law.
Precisely.
That,
yeah.
Anybody who thereafter acts under its provisions, just by reason of the existence of the law, that private person is not acting like as a state. That's your point.
That is precisely.
The simple enactment of the law doesn't make the action of Mr. Flagg and Flagg Brothers state action.
Yes.
The question isn't whether it's state action. Isn't the question whether it's action under color of state law?
I think those two terms are basically interchangeable. They have, I think, in the past, been used alternatively and perhaps confusingly. I think that this is not the case to make any distinction.
I wrote
whether
an opinion
it's under
once saying there's quite a difference between the two. I guess nobody
read it. if I was... if this was before a fireplace, that might be the time and the place. But I think in the context of this case, basically under color of state law and state action are basically interchangeable
Well,
terms.
Really, what we have here is whether we're relying on the language of 1983 or whether we're relying on the language of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that could be a difference, but perhaps that's fireside discussion.
I think that we basically have to go back to Section 1983 is derived from and based on the 14th Amendment, and I think this Court has so held.
Well, don't you have to have both here, as a matter of fact? You have to have, under color of state law, a deprivation of a constitutional right, and the constitutional right is that you not be deprived of due process by the state.
Yes, that is a fair statement. The fact of the matter is there has to be some, once again getting back to the magic words, there must be some state action that has deprived you of your constitutional rights. Because
well, there is no constitutional right unless there is a deprivation by the state. That's the point.
Yes, basically, of course.
Deprivation by a private individual is not a violation of person's constitutional right, no matter how gross the deprivation might be.
Yes, and I think that was determined back in the civil rights cases, I think, over a century ago.
There's been a lot of water over the dam since then.
Well, I don't think that much. I think the law still has been reaffirmed only a few years ago by this Court in Jackson against Metropolitan Edison. But I think it's worthwhile to emphasize to this Court that not only has New York passed the Uniform Commercial Code, 48 other state legislatures plus the District of Columbia have passed this section that's under challenge here. So, of course, it's rather obvious we have a statute with nationwide impact. And this statute simply regulates and authorizes the exercise of a power of nonjudicial sale by the warehouseman where his customer may have disappeared, done any sort of thing, and not paid his bill. Now, there may be a dispute about the bill, but that's something else. That's not a constitutional dispute. And as I say, speaking about the UCC, this statute, though, dates much further back than UCC, which is a product of a distinguished group of legal authorities of the late 50s and early 1960s. It dates back in New York, back to 1879. And it is based on, and I'd emphasize this, it's part of a uniform statutory scheme of a warehouseman having a specific possessory lien over stored goods in his possession, and the statute, by regulating sale by the warehouseman, is basically a wholesome statute. And
what difference does it make when New York first enacted the statute? Supposing that there was no statute on the books and no decisional law in New York, had just become a member of the Union, and the Court of Appeals was first established and had no cases at all on this subject, and this precise case came before it. The Court of Appeals would have had to decide one way or another whether the Bailey had a right to sell without going to court, wouldn't it?
Well, I'd put it this way. Age is not a determinative factor, and of course, but when we speak of, and this court has spoken, traditional function of the state, it becomes of interest, and I simply say of interest, how old is a statute, because when the court below, this Court of Appeals decision, said that we had transferred by the UCC provision a traditional function of the state, and I can cite, and they even themselves cite, the fact that it dates back to 1879 and perhaps and even old and even longer in other states, it hardly becomes a traditional state function for a warehouseman to exercise the power of nonjudicial sale when his lien, which is not under question here, is still outstanding.
Are you going to touch at any time on the question of possible mootness?
Well, I have in my brief, of course, pointed out that...
If you want to rely on the brief, you may do so.
Yes, I would prefer to rely on my brief. As I say, I have many things to say here, and I think they go to the merits. As I say, and I mentioned the Jackson against Metropolitan Edison case, which had to do with utility cutoffs, this court went to the extent of enumerating what are traditional functions of the state. And quite interestingly, not one of them even closely approached nonjudicial sale by a warehouseman or anyone else. It's really a total stretch of the imagination to call nonjudicial sale, which was only threatened in the instant case and never carried out or cannot be now, to call that a traditional function of a sheriff, because a sheriff has a significant power of sovereignty that the warehouseman does not have. Basically stated, a sheriff seizes property, and this is something that a warehouseman cannot do, did not do in this case, and never will do, because his lien is based on voluntary, consensual possession. And there's another aspect when you're speaking about state action. It has been generally recognized that this court and any court is much quicker to find a delegation of a state function, a traditional state function, in a case that involves racial discrimination, because that racial discrimination is at the heart of the purpose of the 14th Amendment when it was passed. And what we all know is that debtor-creditor relations really had nothing to do with the passage of the 14th Amendment. It was not involved one iota. And I think it's rather obvious that in New York, a sale by a warehouseman like they are challenging here and claiming the state action the respondents are claiming is not a traditional state function. Now, there is some authority in the New York Court of Appeals which the respondents cite says it is a traditional state function. That is the Bly case. But I emphasize, and I was involved in the Bly case. I argued that for the Attorney General up in Albany. That case involved a lien sale. It did not involve a lien, no, involved, excuse me, liens, simply liens, not a lien sale. It involved an innkeeper's lien, which is a basically different type of lien than a warehouseman's lien. And finally, and most importantly, decision of the New York Court of Appeals simply doesn't control this court. Even the cases that respondent cites show that you make an independent determination in a case where there's a federal constitutional issue. And once again, I would emphasize that the question of state action here is one of great importance because at the present time, we have a conflict in the circuits. The Ninth Circuit in California has clearly
stated... Mr. Greenwald, you're down to 5 minutes.
Yes, I'm going to...
Are you going to get to the Chief Judge's question of mootness? As I understand it, that Ms. Jones paid the money, and that the other one, by agreement, they removed them.
Well, as I said, I said, and the Chief Justice accepted my statement that I would rely on...
Well, I didn't.
But you have... Okay, then I will... address my answer. Yes, the point is that Mrs. Jones, the late Mrs. Jones, at the termination of the district court case, by her own action, paid her bill and got her goods back. It wasn't a case of Mr. Altman trying to move this case out. This was a matter of the plaintiff taking action, in effect, to resolve the question. Of course, she now states that she didn't get all her goods back and some were in damaged condition, but that is a state law question. It's certainly not a constitutional issue. And I might point out also, of course, that my co-counsel has differing views as to the mootness of this case, and he has a client who is very anxious to get this matter resolved because it has been around for an awful long time. But I have pointed out to Your Honors that having an actual case of controversy is a necessary ingredient of the case, and I felt the obligation to inform Your Honors. At this point, I would like to reserve my
Mayor, just time before you sit down, Mr. Greenwald, we have an amicus brief here from the New York State Consumer Protection Board taking a position opposed to yours.
Yes.
You represent the state of New York, and this is a state agency. How's the...
Well, once again, arguments? Yes. And this is the second time, at least in my own personal experience, that you have a brief, amicus brief, opposing the Attorney General from the Consumer Protection Board.
From a state agency?
Yes. Well, they are not... They perform some state function. As we say, it's questionable who they represent. It's also questionable and is not questionable. There's no doubt under New York state law they have no right to come into court cases, even when this law gives them a right to appear at a regulatory agency hearing, a public service commission. They, even though they could appear at that hearing, they can't then go in to challenge the matter.
But
so I emphasize that the views of the state of New York are presented by the Attorney General,
right,
not the Consumer Protection Board.
Mr. Schwartz.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Before I commence my argument, I would like to address the question of mootness. Mrs. Jones claims that the $1,600 payment she made during the course of the litigation was not made voluntarily, but at least in part because of the threat of sale. She would have a claim for damages, at least for part of that $1,600 payment. In addition, I closely point out to the court that the defendants charged Mrs. Jones an auctioneer's fee, presumably for a scheduled sale. And under the code, in order for a person whose goods are stored to exercise a right of redemption, part of the cost which must be paid are the fees involved in the carrying out of the contemplated or actual sale. I think this claim for damages is sufficient to keep the case alive. I would also point out that in all of these consumer due process cases which have been brought the last few years, there is virtually an inherent problem in mootness. We pointed this out to the circuit court. We prepared an appendix in the circuit court which listed the various cases and the status of the goods during the litigation. And it is inevitable that a threat of sale will not continue during an entire lengthy litigation period. We brought this case at the time the threat of sale existed. We submit that was its proper time to bring the case, to try to stop the sale. The lawsuit served that purpose. But it's not reasonable to suppose that that threat will continue during the course of a 3 or 4 year litigation period. I would say that the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine would also apply to this type of situation. And I would also point out...
Well, the woman that seemed to me, the woman I think it was, who can pay $1,600 is not automatically in danger of not being able to pay storage in the future. She paid $1,600.
But she claims that one reason for that $1,600
payment...
Yeah,
I know, payment, but she did Ramsey to get together $1,600.
But she claims it was not a voluntary payment. This woman was left with all of her without all of her possessions for virtually a 2 year period, Your Honor. And of course, the payment of the auctioneer's fee would only have to be made because the statute was invoked against her. I also would like to point out that we have filed an action on behalf of a client whose goods have been sold already in the Southern District, and it's assigned to the same judge before whom the Brooks case was assigned. And the only reason that we could not move to intervene that client into the Brooks action is because the circuit court stayed its own mandate remanding the action to the district court pending proceedings in this court. So there is another case which has been filed. I say it was just a mere formality. I would also point out that the parties did stipulate to the propriety of the class here. There was no certification. The district court never so ordered the stipulation, but we...
Well, some of the parties stipulated, not all of the...
Well, at the time the stipulation was entered into, Your Honor, the Attorney General and the associations were not parties to the lawsuit.
But now they are.
Now they are, but...
And they haven't stipulated.
I would also point out that the action clearly meets all of the requirements of Rule 23A and B2. It's clearly the type of action that Subdivision B2 was intended to apply to. I understand that, Your Honor. I'm just saying that it's another factor to consider. If the case was remanded back to the district court as the circuit court contemplated, the circuit court opinion, I believe, contemplates that the action is a proper class action, but that the only question is the propriety of the scope. We did everything possible to get this class certified. We entered into a stipulation, went through oversight or whatever, the stipulation wasn't approved, we moved for class certification, the district judge didn't pass on the certification,
and then you asked for summary judgment.
We moved for a class certification and summary judgment at the same time, Your Honor. We then appealed from the denial of the class certification as well. As I say, the only reason there's any mootness problem here at all is because the circuit court stayed its own mandate. Otherwise, this new client, Mrs. Svensson, would have intervened into the Brooks action, but we do have an action filed on behalf of somebody whose goods are sold. Your Honors, the plaintiff's contention is that state action is present in this case because we have a direct, precise, and significant nexus between the state and the contested activity. The state has delegated to warehousemen the extraordinary power to summarily sell a bailor's goods. And in doing so, we contend that New York has delegated to warehousemen the public functions of lien enforcement and non-consensual dispute resolution.
Without that delegation, where would the power of sale be?
There would be no power of sale, Your Honor. And despite what my adversary said, the authorities are in consistent agreement, and we've cited them in the brief. There was no power of sale at common law. It is clear. I don't know how my adversary could make the statement to the contrary. Bailey's right at common law was merely the right to retain possession of the goods.
And go to court. He could go to court.
He could go to court. The norm at common law, if the Bailey sought to enforce his lien, his remedy was to bring an action in court. And if he proved his claim and defeated defenses and obtained a judgment, the sheriff would then levy execution on the very goods that were sold.
Well, in some respects, that involves almost more state action than this, doesn't it?
I would say that this is a direct substitute for that process. That is a judicial process, judicial determination, and judicial enforcement. And our position is that a person whose goods are sold under this statute, under Section 7-210, stands in the precise posture of a defendant in a judicial action against whom a judgment has been gotten and enforced, with one exception. And that exception is that the person whose goods are sold under Section 7-210 does not get an opportunity to be heard prior to sale, whereas the person whose goods are sold after a judicial proceeding, presumably does.
Well, is your claim of state action based on the legislature's enactment of the statute?
Our primary claim, Your Honor, is that the enactment of the statute constitutes the delegation of power which is normally associated with sovereignty.
Supposing that without any such statute, the New York Court of Appeals, as a matter of common law, had reached precisely the same result.
My position would have to be the same. If the New York courts, if the New York Court of Appeals had recognized that the ostensibly private sector has the power to exercise functions which are governmental in nature, we would nevertheless have a delegation from the public sector to the private sector of governmental power.
So it's not the enactment of the statute. It's the any recognition by a body in New York that is capable of laying down law that a warehouseman has a defense to a conversion action in this situation.
It's the delegation of sovereign power by any branch of the government. That's right, Your
Honor.
Well,
you say delegation of sovereign power, but all it really is a defense to a conversion action.
It's more than a defense, Your Honor, because these goods are sold without a hearing.
Well, but in a conversion action, the goods may have been taken without a hearing.
A conversion action would come about because of an unlawful sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
here, what this statute does is make this sale lawful. It makes what would have been an unlawful act a lawful act.
So it gives them a defense to an otherwise unlawful act.
But it gives them more than a defense. It gives them much more than a defense. It gives them a defense if an action in conversion is brought. But if an action in conversion is not brought, it gives them the power to resolve this dispute by selling a person's goods summarily.
Well, just as if a converter takes your goods and does away with them, and you never sue him, he gets away scot-free.
Well, that's true, but if a case was brought, it would be an unlawful act. The state here is making lawful what would otherwise be clearly unlawful at common law. There's no question of that.
Well, that alone, certainly, you've got to go further than that.
We don't rely on that alone. We the heart of our claim is this, that this person whose goods are sold stands in the same position as a defendant in a judicial proceeding against whom a judgment was taken and against whom that judgment was enforced by the power of sale of his goods. And we will say that what involved here are the combination functions of non-consensual dispute resolution, which is normally, historically, and traditionally carried out by the courts, together with lien enforcement, which is the enforcing mechanism, which is normally carried out by sheriffs and constables.
If it were clear at common law that this power of sale existed, would you be making the same argument?
I would have to consistently, Your Honor, because the common law would then be recognizing that the private sector has what we claim to be a power of the sovereign. But
You view the argument as to what the common law was to be immaterial.
No, I don't think it's immaterial. Perhaps the circuit court stated the proposition too broadly when they spoke about the statutory reversal of the common law in a vacuum. I think the statutory reversal of the common law is relevant in two somewhat limited respects. First of all, how the function was carried out at common law tends to give us some evidence as to whether that function was in the private and public sector. For example, in this case, it's clear that the private sector did not have the power to determine these disputes and to enforce liens. So it's some evidence that the power was not lodged in the private sector at common law. And on the contrary, in response to Mr. Justice White's question, I stated that what happened at common law was that the lien would, in fact, be enforced after a judicial proceeding and enforcement by the sheriff, so that at common law, this is a function which historically and traditionally was carried out by courts and sheriffs and constables. In addition, I think the lack of common law authority is significant in that it shows that when the warehouseman does exercise his power, he is acting under and only under this particular statute. He must be acting in reliance upon the statute.
Would you be making the same argument if all of state law said is it? In Baylor-Bailey situations, we'll go just by the contract, whatever the parties agree to. If the parties agree to a private sale, that's the end of it. That would be state authorization of a private sale, and that would be enough for you, I take it.
Your question presupposes a valid contract.
Yes, it does.
All right. If we had a valid contractual power of sale, I would say that this would be a prime example of a creditor's remedy which came about as a result of a contractual voluntary agreement. That is
even though it comes about because of the state law simply authorizes parties to agree on a private sale. Would that be state action?
Well, now you're assuming the existence of the statute.
Yes, I am. I'm just trying to find out.
Then there would be state action because the only let me make sure I have this question straight. We have the statutory power of sale.
The statute says whatever the parties agree to with respect to a private sale is all right with us. That's what the statute says. And the parties agree to a private sale. Now, is the state involved in that?
If it's totally contractual, I would say that the state is not involved.
But the whole source of enforcement of law for contracts is the state sovereignty under Austin or anybody else. In many societies, a written agreement between two parties is not enforced by the sovereign.
But if we have a valid contract with a power of sale in that contract...
Well, valid, you've automatically had reference to state law right there.
Well, we may have reference to state law, but the power of sale came about because the parties mutually, consensually agreed that upon default the warehouseman would have the power of sale. That's not what we have in this case. In this case, we have a power of sale which exists only by operation of the statute.
Well, you do agree that there's a lien.
We do not
in
contest...
In common law, there was a lien.
We do not contest the lien. The constitutionality of the lien, we are not contesting.
What does a lien mean, that you can sell it?
The lien at common law is defined as the right to detain the goods indefinitely until the bailor makes all the payments which the bailee claims are due and owing.
And
that is all.
No, then he can go to court.
He can go to court, but any other creditor can go to court too. The norm is for a creditor who claims he has an amount due and owing to bring a judicial proceeding, prove his claim. If he can defeat defenses, obtain a judgment, and seek to enforce that judgment. This statute, in effect, short-circuits that entire process. If I could get back to Mr. Justice White's question, the difference between a contractual power of sale and the statutory power of sale is the difference between voluntary dispute resolution, which has historically and traditionally been in the private sector, and involuntary, non-consensual dispute resolution, which has historically and traditionally been the function of the courts and sheriffs. Well, I see that it's 12 o'clock, if I might complete my argument after.
Well, we'll allow you to start at 1 o'clock then.
Thank you.
You may continue, Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Your Honor. In Jackson versus Metropolitan Edison Company, this court stated that the characterization which the state courts give to a function as to whether that function is public or private in nature, is entitled to weight in making the determination whether the state has delegated a public function to the ostensibly private sector. The rationale for this, we respectfully submit, is that just as the state courts have the expertise...
Well, now you say a public function. You sort of lost me there. What about the state of New York, I assume, grants licenses to... grant licenses to truck lines as well as...
The granting of the license itself, of course, would be a public function, but the activities carried out under that license might be public, might be private, depending upon the nature of the powers that were delegated.
Well, some trucking companies own warehouses, and some warehousing companies own lines of trucks, too, don't they?
Well, the general everyday activities of warehouse companies, I would concede, are functions which are private in nature. They're generally contractual relationships, contracts of moving and storage. The question here is whether the state's delegation of the power of summary sale is of that type of nature, whether it's private in nature, or whether this is the type of function which historically and traditionally has been associated with sovereignty, whether it's a public function. And my point is that the characterization given by a state court as to whether that function is public or private in nature should be given some weight by this court in making that determination. And the rationale for that is that the state courts, just as they have the expertise on questions of state law, are in a particularly good position, particularly the highest court in the state, to evaluate whether a function is public or private in the particular state. And in this case, in New York, the New York Court of Appeals, in Bly versus Globe Wernick Company, has concluded that in New York, lien enforcement historically and traditionally has been the function of the sheriff. Now, the Attorney General seeks to distinguish the Bly case as a case involving a seizure of goods under the innkeeper's lien law. However, the Court of Appeals in Bly did not hold that it's a seizure which constitutes a public function, but rather held that it's the execution of a lien, regardless of the method of lien enforcement, which in New York has been the function of the sheriff, and in fact cited two types of liens, judgment liens and liens which arise from an action to judicially foreclose a mortgage, which are liens which can be enforced by sale and without seizure. In addition, the appellate division in New York has concluded that lien enforcement, where accomplished by sale and without seizure, is also a function which historically and traditionally has been the function of the sheriff in New York.
But you don't contend that the actual sale is an act by the state, do you?
It's not an act by a state official, but we say
Well, is it by the state?
Yes.
It is an act which is equivalent to the exercise of sovereign power. It is something which we contend.
Well, you wouldn't say the state is liable for example, the person misuses the power.
We would not say the state is liable any more so than that we would say that the state would be liable in Evans versus Newton in the case where the function of running a park has been delegated. It's public under the state action doctrine. It doesn't mean that the state has liability for the acts of the defendant. That would be true in all the public function cases which this court has decided. I would also stress that the decisions...
But your point is that this defendant has liability as though it were the state.
That our point is that this defendant is bound to comply with the 14th Amendment
as though it were a state.
That's
and therefore
right.
It's liable under 1983.
That's right. But that does not make the state qua state liable, which I took to be Mr. Justice White's question.
Well, I think it was.
Can you... I suppose that if a... where the foreclosure is done by a sheriff, and the sheriff goes out, and if he absconds or if he does something wrong, perhaps you could sue him under 1983.
The sheriff would be liable, with the one exception that he would faith immunity from liability for damages. He is subject to liability in the first under Section 19.
In the warehouseman's situation, if the private seller misperforms, can you sue him under 1983?
Well, that raises a question which
I believe... Is it state action or isn't it?
We contend that it is state action. Whether damages would flow from the private party's wrong in this situation, whether this...
But you could get into court on a 1983
case. We could get into court on a 1983 action.
Claiming that this private seller was exercising state power and therefore should answer for...
Injunctive relief... declaratory relief, and damages, with the possible exception that whether or not this defendant would have a good faith immunity is, I believe, a question which this court has not answered. In other words, whether this type of defendant would have the same immunity as a sheriff or other executive or administrative official. I only qualified in that respect. The decisions of the New York courts...
But at least the sheriff, when he's making the sale, is a neutral... But when the sale is made under a power of sale, either express or implied, the selling official is not a neutral, is he?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And we contend that makes this statute worse than the statutes which were involved in the Schneider Act Fuentes and Dicem cases.
Would your theory make all powers of sale under mortgages and trusts of both real and personal property state action?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because they come about as a result of a contractual agreement. We sharply distinguish.
But it's a substitute for what I think you have at least implied is the traditional common law sovereign act.
It's a substitute, Your Honor, when it's exercised as a result of non-consensual dispute resolution, when it's a substitute for the functions exercised by the courts and sheriff. It is not a substitute when it comes about as a result of a voluntary mutual agreement between the parties. That historically and traditionally has been in the private sector.
Mr. Schwartz, may I ask you a question? Or excuse me, Mr. Schwartz. If there were compliance or non-compliance with a statutory procedure, say the failure to give a notice of statute required, something like that, would you say that was state action?
Sure.
Could you sue in a federal court on the ground that there was a failure to comply with the state
the
procedure?
The failure to give the notice might constitute not only a state law wrong, but if there is state action in this case as we contend, then it would also constitute a violation of the due process clause. Because our substantive claim is that an owner of the goods should be given adequate notice and some opportunity to be heard prior to
but
sale.
But if he acts without the statute, without complying with the statute, is he then acting under color of state law?
Your Honor, he might be acting in violation of state law, but in threatening to sell or in engaging in the sale of itself, he would necessarily be invoking the power of the statute. Otherwise, he could not sell.
See, what I'm really asking is it your position that the federal court has jurisdiction of every case arising under one of these statutes, or are you only contending that the court has jurisdiction to determine the constitutionality of the basic procedure? I guess you're arguing the former.
We are only arguing that the court has the jurisdiction to determine whether there's been a constitutional violation, a violation of due process, which I take it to be the latter.
But there could be a violation of due process resulting from a failure to follow the state
procedure.
That's
right, because our basic claim is that due process requires some opportunity to be heard prior to the sale. The statute does not provide for any opportunity.
And you say there's the same kind of state action whether or not the defendant complies with the statutory procedure.
I can't see a distinction, Your Honor, because the...
Well, in one case, he's acting under color of the state law, and in the other case, he's acting contrary to the state law.
But
you don't draw a distinction.
In exercising the power of sale, he's invoking the statutory power. He may have engaged in some procedural irregularity along the way, but when he makes that determination to sell, and he in fact sells, he is acting under color of that statute.
Well, suppose it's a fraudulent sale. Suppose he sells it at an unconscionably low price to his brother-in-law, and he just steals. Now he's exercising the state authority, you say, and so you could sue him under 1983 and recover damages.
That's right, but not because it was fraudulent.
No, I understand
because of the due process violation.
Because he's exercising at the threshold.
Now,
he's exercising
and whether he conducted a fraudulent sale or didn't comply with the procedural requirements, those are all, of course, generally questions
of
state law.
Well, the state deprived him of his property without due process.
That's right. I might also say that those are normally questions which would be determined at a hearing prior to the sale. In other words, whether the warehouseman has a proper lien, the amount of the charges, the extent of the lien, whether the proper notification provisions were given and so forth, those are questions, primarily questions of state law, which would be resolved at a due process hearing prior to the sale. It's the lack of that mechanism that brings us to this court.
And Mr. Schwartz, what about the provision in the contract that they have this right?
Your Honor, there is no contractual power of sale in this case. In the case of Plaintiff Jones, the complaint alleges no contractual authorization for storage and transportation at all. In the case of Plaintiff Brooks, the bill of lading, which was given to Mrs. Brooks, and I refer you to page 19A of the record, in the most minute print imaginable, refers to a right of sale if goods are not claimed after shipment upon destination. That refers to a carrier's lien and a carrier's right to sell if the purchase it.
That's not a warehouse.
That is not a warehouse lien.
Well, what would a warehouse lien Goodwin do to your argument?
Your Honor, a valid contractual power of sale would result in a lack of state action. But we would point out that in the Fuentes case, this court indicated that there are several factors that might lead a court as a matter of state law to conclude that this type of contractual power of sale would be an invalid contract of adhesion. The unequal bargaining power, the fact that the term isn't really bargained for, if it's in a form contract, a fine print form contract, these would be other factors which might lead the court to conclude that there was no valid contractual power of sale.
But
it's exactly the same problem.
Your argument leads you, doesn't it, doesn't your argument lead you to the conclusion that you could have a voluntary agreement between the bailor and bailee here, which didn't comply with the uniform warehouse, with the UCC provision, but was perfectly valid under the 14th Amendment, since it was entirely consensual?
If there is a consensual power of sale, and it was valid as a matter of state law...
No, supposing it's invalid as a matter of state law.
Well, then we would not have a contractual power of sale. Then, in that case, the power of sale would arise wholly from the statute, and the sale would be an involuntary act.
Invalid would mean there was no coercion, no anything.
That's right.
But valid is the word that decides it, whether or not it's valid.
I agree, Your Honor.
So it isn't just any consensual agreement that it gets you the state out from under, or the warehouseman out from under the 14th Amendment here. It has to be not only consensual, but it must also comply with the state statute, which you say has delegated to the warehouseman the state's ordinary function.
Absolutely, because that would be a prerequisite for a valid contractual power of sale. And I say the distinction is critical in this case, the distinction between contractual voluntary powers which the parties agree to confer upon a creditor, such as the Article 9 secured transactions. Now, on the one hand,
in this case, are you contending that your adversary violated the statute in any way?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
So we don't have a problem of whether or not a violation of the statute could be state action.
We don't have that problem. In the case of Jones, we don't have a contract at all. In the case of Brooks, we say that that clause doesn't pertain to a warehouseman's lien. Even if it did, it would be invalid as a contract of adhesion. That's what the court below stated.
Do the members of the class that was stipulated, are they all parties who had no contracts?
The class was not limited in that respect, but I would have to concede that the class should be limited in that respect. Your Honors, in enforcing liens, warehousemen have been engaged in the enforcement of non-consensual binding dispute resolution. This has been and always has been and remains an essential attribute of sovereignty. According to Locke, one of the great and fundamental basic purposes of government is the protection of property by the establishment of courts to resolve disputes consensually when the parties cannot voluntarily do so. From the early common law, and it remains so today, self-help remedies have always been very strictly limited. And we submit to this court that our system of law recognizes that a person who's interested in the dispute, such as a warehouseman, should not have the power. I see that my time is up.
You may finish your sentence.
A person who is interested in a dispute, such as the warehouseman, should not have the power to unilaterally resolve that dispute by the foresale of another person's property without giving that other person an opportunity to be heard. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Schwartz, do you have anything further, Mr. Greenwald?
In response to the respondent's argument, early on there was a mention of, and it's been mentioned again, a stipulation about class action. As has been recognized by this court, the Attorney General didn't sign this, and many other parties did not sign this so-called class action stipulation. So we are parties to this case, so are these other people, so it basically is inoperative. Furthermore, I think I should emphasize that the respondent seems to be saying that he wants us to bring, not us, the warehouseman to bring, serve a summons and complaint and bring a court action. As has been pointed out, I think, in the reply brief of the petitioner Flagg Brothers, That brings into play when the sheriff goes out to execute the judgment lien, brings into play the question of the household goods exemption provided by New York State statute, and makes a world of problems which I don't have time to go into now. Now, I think that there's, once again, there's a claim here that there isn't an opportunity to be heard. Well, the claim, as I now hear it, that there's no opportunity to be heard, he says he has no opportunity to be heard before the sale. Well, that's questionable. But what I wish to emphasize to Your Honors is that the sale is not such a significant event. The customer can be heard before the sale if he has a vigorous attorney and that he wants to be heard before the sale, seeking an injunction or the like, or he can be heard, as he very frequently is, after the sale, claiming an inaction and conversion if the sale wasn't properly conducted and the like. This is a complete opportunity to be heard. It can result
but
in
but
the...
But that's after his property, some of it perhaps personal, irreplaceable personal property, has been sold.
Well, once again, I would point out that we're dealing here with personal property, and you use the term irreplaceable. I would say with personal property, it can be replaced by money.
Well,
money
maybe,
will
maybe,
replace
maybe
it.
Family portraits and so on cannot be.
Well, there's no allegation here that any of these matters were family. And by the way, I'd also say that this is stored goods also.
That goes to really the question of whether there's a violation of the due process rather than the state action issue, I guess.
Right.
May I just ask you one question on the state action issue? Sometimes a hypothetical will illustrate a position. Supposing New York passed a statute that said that if a man is large enough and strong enough, he can go next door and take his neighbor's chattels, his lawnmower and one thing and another, and then he has the power to sell them to a third party and give good title. And someone does that, pursuant to that statute. And he could you get federal jurisdiction to challenge that statute?
Well, that raises another issue, which is not in this case. That raises the issue of general non-possessory liens, which is a totally different problem from the warehouse.
I'm just asking, under that hypothetical, do you think the man would be acting under color of state law within the meaning of 1983?
Well, I don't think that question is before us, but I would say that the state of New York cannot authorize someone to do a wrongful act.
Well, but the question is, how do we decide when state action is involved?
Well,
when action is authorized by a statute, but no state official participates. Is it your view that unless a state official participates, there's never state action?
Well, I would say that where a state official does not participate, it's much more difficult to find state action. In racial
Could you ever find it? That's the question.
Well, basically, you might never find, unless it's a racial discrimination case, which, or a classic governmental function like
that. Your answer is that in my case, there'd be no state action. I think that's your position.
Yes, but I don't think you'd get very far relying on such a law, and of course such a law has never been passed.
No, but you'd be able to rely on in federal court. You could dismiss on the ground that there's no federal jurisdiction.
Well,
isn't that your position here?
No, that's not my position here, because the type of lien we're...
Well, what has that got to do with whether the private individual is acting on behalf of the state?
Well, I think it has a lot to do, because you have to focus upon the type of lien that the warehouseman has. He has a lien by the voluntary, there's a question, you know, basically by the delivery by the customer of property for moving and storage to the warehouseman. The customer wants to have his goods taken care of. And not surprisingly, the warehouseman expects to be paid. The law provides a lien for this
because
service.
There's greater legal involvement, there's less state action? I don't understand.
Well, I would put it this way.
What is your test of when there's state action in a case like this?
Well, I would say that you have to have a traditional state function involving the best example is racial discrimination or free speech, a fundamental right, a restriction on a fundamental right.
That's what he said. He wants a little due process.
Well, I don't think due process would help him.
Just one moment. He doesn't object to you giving the warehouseman a lien. He doesn't object to that. He objects to you selling the property.
Well, I think that...
Not granting the lien.
Well, I think that giving him due process would be a illusory benefit, because due process as we all know, can have in this case a very substantial cost. And in the end, the person who's going to pay this cost is the customer. And we're dealing here, allegedly, with people who don't have a lot of money.
Well, he's asking to pay for it.
No, he has never yet. In the end, he will pay for it because the bill that he's going to receive in the first instance is going to...
If a man wants due process, don't tell him that he can't have it because he'll have to pay for it.
Well, that's a factor this court has considered in its other case, in other cases.
Well, do we have to consider it in this case?
No, because you're on the state action issue. You're not on the due process issue.
Mr. Greenwald, what if the New York legislature decided that the courts of New York were so congested that they just had to eliminate some kind of claims for relief, and they decided to eliminate any civil action for conversion?
Well,
do you think that would implicate state action so that someone who had previously had a claim for conversion could go into the district court and say, the state has taken away my claim?
No, because we actually had that case with our no-fault law, and I think it was appealed up to this court, where we, under the no-fault insurance provision, we provided that any dispute about no-fault the benefits, auto insurance, is subject to binding arbitration. It basically was taken out of the courts of the state of New York because we do have a lot of congestion in our courts, and I think that is the example that is operative in that situation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.